This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 244.
This podcast is brought to you by Acer. Looking for a laptop that delivers on both performance and price? The Acer Swift 5 offers a powerful Intel Core processor, super slim design, and more. Go to acer.com, click on store, and enter the coupon code TRAINING at checkout to receive 10% off plus free ground shipping on a Swift Series laptop, including already discounted models. Offer valid through April 30th, 2018, and limited to one per qualified order. That's acer.com, and use the code TRAINING. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we help you dig deep and go the distance. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we bring you a fascinating interview with Alex Hutchinson, author of the new book, Endure: Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. And of course, to get expert help in your marathon training, you can learn about our coaching services and academy membership when you visit marathontrainacademy.com. So, Angie, you have another race on the calendar. You signed up for a marathon in Rhode Island.
That's right. I signed up for the Newport Road Race Marathon. It takes place on April 14th, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, I just realized. So I'm excited.
Of course, as many of you know, Angie's working on her 50-state goal, running a marathon in all 50 states. So this will be her Rhode Island Marathon. After that, I think you'll only have about 10 states left.
9, to be exact.
Wow. making progress. That's awesome. Well, this is a great interview we have for you folks today with Alex Hutchinson. Before we get into that, we'd like to give some shout-outs here to folks out there who listen to the podcast. Angie, what do you got for us?
That's right. This is from Terry in the Academy. She says, thank you so much to everyone who gave me tips and recommendations leading up to the LA Marathon, and especially the LA-specific advice. A huge thanks to Academy member Peter for giving me a cheer on the course. It was much appreciated. I finished in 4:31:33, which was a big PR, and I enjoyed the run, which was much more important than time.
Love it. It's nice to see, you know, when we've had other members who have been at races and they can kind of give heads up, you know, about what to expect, and sometimes meet up there, meet one another, and cheer each other on.
Yeah, that's right.
So big congrats, Terry, on finishing the marathon in 4:31:33 and earning a massive PR.
And this note comes from Courtney in the Academy. She says, hello, fellow MTAers. Yesterday, I ran my third marathon at the Tomoka Marathon in Florida. The course winds through two state parks and along the intracoastal waterway and was absolutely beautiful. During the race, I talked to all kinds of people, which was inspiring. I was doing fine in the race, definitely on track to PR, when my left hip flexor decided it was done at mile 24. I've had that happen before, no fun.
Yeah.
I slowed down to a pace that I could maintain and kept going. The only massive obstacle between me and the finish was the Granada Bridge at mile 25.5. I speedwalked as fast as possible, knowing I was just moments from the finish, and resumed running at the top for the last 0.2 miles. I crossed the finish line strong in 4:42, which was a 38-minute PR.
Wow.
I want to give a big shout-out to MTA coach Lynn, who provided me with such great coaching and feedback over the last few months. When I signed up for personal coaching, I thought they might think I was crazy going for such a huge PR. But Coach Lynn always encouraged me and helped me believe that I was strong enough. Oh, and I placed in my age group.
Love it. Big congrats on that, Courtney. You know, folks might think it's odd that she had to walk because of hip flexor pain, but then was able to run in the last 0.2, probably saw the finish line and was able to run. That's quite common. And actually, our conversation with Alex is going to talk about why we have that finishing kick and why we're able to, like, grind through pain when we see the finish line.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But as far as like hip flexor pain goes, Angie, that's something that you've dealt with. Where is that pain at anyway?
It's in the front of your hip area. So yeah, definitely uncomfortable. Usually it comes from having weak glutes. Mm-hmm. So then your hip flexors have to take over. A lot of times tightness in the hips can cause that as well. So it's definitely something I battle as well. That's one reason I try to keep up my lower body strength training and keep my core strong. And this note comes from Kathleen. She says, I wanted to share my experience at the Shamrock Virginia Beach races that I did on St. Paddy's weekend. I did the Dolphin Challenge, which was the 8K on Saturday and the half marathon on Sunday, and I had a great time. It was a nice flat course with a beautiful view of the beach near the finish. I unexpectedly got a PR for the half marathon with a time of 2:05. My last PR was 12 years ago. I never thought I could keep my pace for that long, but thanks to the support of MTA and the training plans, I pulled through. I'm also grateful that I felt good post-race and was injury-free.
Well, that's what we love to hear. Big congrats, Kathleen, on holding the pace and staying injury-free, because that's what it's all about.
And this final email comes from Justin. He says, I've been a devoted fan and MTA podcast listener for the past year, and I just wanted to say thank you for all that you do. I recently completed my first full marathon, the Napa Valley Marathon, a month shy of my 38th birthday, and a mere 3 years after my very first 5K. Last year, I didn't think completing a marathon was even remotely conceivable, but thanks to awesome virtual coaches like you two, I not only finished the race, but I blitzed past my goal of 4 hours, finishing with a time of 3 hours and 46 minutes. I had so much fun running the race that I resolved to sign up for another one, possibly even later this year. Like some of your loyal listeners, I created a 26.2 miles of gratitude list, devoting every mile to someone who helped me along this challenging journey. Thinking of those folks at each mile marker undoubtedly helped me power through the pain. Note, he says, I had you two at mile 12. God bless, Justin.
All right. Thank you, Justin, for that nice email. Congrats on your first marathon, and you made great time. 3:46, that's an awesome finishing time for your first marathon. And Angie talked about 26.2 miles of gratitude. Staying positive during a race is so important, which Alex, our guest, is going to talk about as well. But if you had to make a list, what are you grateful for?
I guess a strong, healthy body, because I wouldn't be doing the race without that.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have things, you know, things that we'd like to change about ourselves. But when it comes down to, I think all of us are grateful for the strength that we have to be able to run and do the things that we do.
So congrats to everyone out there taking action and getting to the next level in your running. We're glad to be on this journey with you. And you're going to love this conversation with Alex Hutchinson. He's a science geek and writer for Outside Magazine, Canadian Running, and Runner's World. And he competed as a middle and long distance runner for the Canadian national team. And he lives in Toronto. His book is called Endure, and it will tell you everything you want to know about the science and psychology of endurance. It's also a very entertaining read, so we definitely highly recommend it. And in this conversation, you're going to hear about the central governor theory, the mind-body connection, how you can affect your race by smiling more, as well as the Nike Breaking 2 project, which happened in 2017 when they got the marathon time down to 2 hours and 25 seconds.
Of course, an unofficial world record.
Yeah, but very impressive nonetheless. Alex was one of the few journalists who were given behind-the-scenes kind of passes to be there and report on it. So anyway, let's get into our conversation with Alex Hutchinson right now. Well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast today with Alex Hutchinson, author of the book Endure. Alex, great to have you on the MTA podcast.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what led to writing this book.
So I guess I would describe myself as a science journalist, and specifically a like science of endurance sports journalist, which isn't really a job, but it's kind of the job I've assigned myself for the last 10 years or so. I write a column for Outside Magazine called Sweat Science, where the focus is basically just looking at new research that's coming out and what it means for the health and performance for endurance athletes, and kind of breaking down the research for a general readership. And I do that actually for a newspaper up in Canada called The Globe and Mail and Canadian Running Magazine. So I do it for a bunch of different publications. I'm a freelancer. I write for a lot of different places, but the unifying theme is science and endurance. And that comes from my sort of background. Before I became a journalist, I was actually a physicist for a while. It wasn't until my late 20s that I decided physics was too hard and I wanted to do something else. So I switched over to journalism just before I turned 30. And that was like 12 or 13 years ago.
But you have your PhD in physics, is that right?
Yeah, I went pretty deep with the physics.
I did
my PhD, and then I spent a couple years working as a postdoctoral researcher with the National Security Agency in Maryland, working on in their quantum computing group. Don't get me wrong, it was interesting. I kind of recognized that some of the people I was working with had incredible passion for the research, and my passion was kind of elsewhere. And I decided I wanted to shift my career over towards where that passion was. And a lot of that passion was in running. I've been running since I was a kid, and I got to a sort of national or low level international level for Canada. I ran on the Canadian national team in track as a middle distance runner, also in cross country, and pretty much any situation where there's a stopwatch and a race on two legs, I kind of enjoyed participating in that.
That's awesome. Now, this book was, I think I heard you say on another interview, like a 10-year project. And it's very comprehensive as far as like following a lot of these threads and going all over the world and talking to many scientists and lots of vignettes also from history and from your own life. So is that right? It was about a 10-year project?
Yeah, I was thinking back and trying to figure out, when did I start working on this darn thing? And I think it was in 2009 that I started telling people I was interviewing. That, hey, I'm working on a book about the limits of endurance. Can I come and, you know, hang out in your lab and learn more about what you're doing? And, you know, one of the first trips I took actually was to South Africa in 2010 to Tim Noakes's lab, who's a very prominent scientist. And I kind of thought at that point it was going to be a 1 or 2 year journey where I was going to just write about the research that I'd come across from Tim Noakes, who's very prominent for. He sort of proposed that when we talk about the physiology of endurance, we're forgetting the brain. And so we have to incorporate the brain. So I was going to write about his research. But what I kept finding is that the deeper I dug, the more threads there were to pull. And then it always turned out to be a little more complicated. Just when I thought I had the full picture, there was more to discover. And eventually, like, as you said, you know, 9 years later, it was more a question of like, all right, well, I could keep researching this book until I die. because the science keeps moving on. It's like, and I don't want to give away the surprise ending or anything, but we don't have like the ultimate answer for what are the limits of human endurance. And I don't see that coming up in 6 months or in 2 years or anything. So at a certain point I have to say, all right, I have a pretty good sense of what we know now. Let's just write where we are now and be as comprehensive as I can. And just, you know, with the understanding that in another 10 years, maybe there'll be a second edition and there'll be some new insights, but really I think it's actually great that we don't have the answers to what are the ultimate limits of endurance. I think the day someone can put me in a lab and test me and say, this is exactly how fast you can run 10 kilometers at your best. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the day I lose interest in running 10 kilometers because part of the fun is not knowing, you know, how you're going to be able to do and how deep you're going to be able to dig.
And I think that's true for many runners. It's that, what is my potential that drives them, you know, to continue pushing and continue training. And I really like how in the book, you know, you talk about the scientists who fall on the side of, you know, it's within the physical body that our limits exist. And then those who kind of say, well, it's more the mind that, you know, shuts the body down, like you were referencing Tim Noakes and his central governor theory. So for those, we've had Tim Noakes on the podcast a couple of times, and he's always fascinating.
Yeah.
So for people who are not familiar with the central governor theory, kind of walk us through that a bit.
Yeah. So I agree. Noakes is a fascinating conversationalist. So in the 1990s, what Tim Noakes started to point out was that we've had a century of physiology where we kind of treat the body like a machine that, you know, just like if you've got a car and you sort of say, well, how fast and how far can this car go? Well, you say how much gas is in the tank and, you know, how much air is in the tires and what's the temperature of the radiator. And if you kind of know those things, you have a complete knowledge of what the car is capable of. And you can, and that's where we were with physiology, that it's like, okay, if we know the VO2 max, if we know the lactate threshold, if we know the running economy, and there are all these things you can measure in the lab, then we will understand the human machine and we will be able to know, you know, how fast a given person can run. And that approach has a lot of power. Like, don't get me wrong. You can learn a lot about someone by taking them into the lab and measuring these parameters, but it doesn't, if you go to the Olympics and take everyone in the lab, everyone on the start line to take them to the lab and run as many tests as you want, you're still not going to know who's going to win the race. There's more to the question. And so that was kind of Noakes's point was, hey, we're kind of studying a car without a driver, and we need to understand that there's a driver, and that driver is the brain that makes decisions on how we use the machinery, and that it's not just a kind of add-on, like the brain only plays a role when you fail or choke or something like that. The brain is a fundamental, like if you're running a race, it's not like you're on a treadmill that's set at a given pace, and the only decision you make is when you're going to fall off the back. When you're running a race, every step is a decision. Every step is a kind of micro decision. Am I speeding up? Am I maintaining this pace, or am I slowing down? And so your brain is constantly making these calculations. And so it's, anyway, to meander back to your actual question, what Noak said is that fundamentally we must have some sort of central governor mechanism in the brain that kind of protects us from going to our absolute physical limit, so that we don't, you know, if you think in evolutionary terms, so that you're not chasing the kudu across the savannah and you just keep running until you actually totally run out of energy, or till your heart, you know, reaches maximum and then you just keel over and die. You know, the cavemen who did that did not pass on their genes. And so exactly how that works or why that works is something people have been debating for a couple decades now. But the idea that when you reach that point that where you feel like you can't continue, it's not because your legs are incapable of continuing. It's because your brain in some way has decided or imposed the decision that you shouldn't keep continuing for your own safety. And as I said, the details are still very much up in the air, but I think that insight is a really important one that has kind of altered the direction of research into endurance over the last couple of decades.
And what are some of the clues or maybe the strongest evidence to the central governor theory?
Yeah, so when I asked Tim Noakes that, to my surprise, I thought he was going to say, well, you know, we hook people up in the lab and we, you know, electrocute them and measure this and measure that. And he said, no, the strongest piece of evidence is just go to any race, stand by the finish line and watch what happens. People come around the corner, they see the finish line and they start sprinting. You know, and that's whether it's the local turkey trot or the Olympics, that's what happens. And at first you kind of think, well, that's just a mistake, because obviously the best way to run is even pace. And, you know, if people are picking it up, it's because they misjudged their pace. They should have been pushing harder earlier. But what Noakes had one of his students do an analysis at one point where he collected the intermediate splits for every world record set in the men's 5,000 and 10,000 meters for the last century or so. So every record in the modern era. So there's like 66 world records have been set. And in 65 of those records, the last kilometer is faster than any other kilometer in the race, except for sometimes the first kilometer. So there's this kind of hardwired pattern where we always find that we have something in reserve at the end. And so the way Noakes interprets this is, you can try as hard as you want. You can try, you know, you're obviously trying to make your effort totally even. But in practice, your brain is kind of tricking you and holding back some energy just to be safe. So that when you see the finish line, when you know you're about to finish, it's like, okay, the danger has passed. We can release this energy now. That's one piece of sort of empirical evidence that was one of the ones that sort of struck me as a runner. It's like, yeah, I've felt that. It's like when I run a 5K and my 4th K is always the slowest and my 5th is the fastest, and I tell myself, don't save anything for the 5th K, you know, like pretend you're only running 4K. And yet that pattern is so hard to override that it feels like there's something deeper going on, something that's imposing its will on me.
Hey, our recording is getting a little garbled. Let me switch to audio only.
Yeah, I'll do the same because I can see that it's...
Are you still there, Alex?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Ooh, that's a lot better.
It does sound better. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and subjectively, you know, like you're saying, in the marathon, which we tend to focus on a lot here on the podcast, you know, I can feel like absolute trash miles 24 and miles 25, and like that final point too, and you know, you see the finish line, it's like put on that final burst and like, wow, I guess I had more in the tank than I thought. You know, how could I pace myself so poorly? And, you know, feel absolutely static once you cross that finish line, like you could keep going. So I tend to really have personal experience with that theory.
I think in the marathon, it's so, the experience of hitting the wall or feeling like you're hitting a wall in a marathon is so physical, right? Like and we have these explanations that we tell ourselves. It's like, well, my muscles are out of fuel. Like I've run out of glycogen. So it's not in my head, or, you know, the muscle damage or whatever the case may be. And then when you're able to speed up at the end, it's like, well, hang on, then how did this whole explanation work? If I was hitting the wall, like if I was literally out of fuel, how am I still going? You know, so it's like you run out of gas on the freeway and then you bang on the side of the car and suddenly you're able to drive again. It forces you to sort of reevaluate what's going on.
Can you bring up or mention a couple other studies that are in the book about like the brain's effect on performance?
Yeah, definitely. Look, another one that I think is a real that has some practical implications, but also kind of illustrates the points that Noakes and others have made. And it's been around for a decade now, is this idea that you can enhance your performance by taking a mouthful of sports drink, swishing it around in your mouth, and then spitting it out. So it's like you're tricking your brain. Your brain thinks there's fuel on the way to your muscles, and then no fuel gets there, and yet you still go faster. So this is crazy enough on its own. But there's some subtleties here that make it even sort of more even crazier. This doesn't work if you use an artificially sweetened drink. So it's not just that you're detecting sweetness and you think, oh, okay, I can go faster. Hmm. It does work if you use a tasteless carbohydrate called maltodextrin. So your brain is somehow detecting the energy content of the drink. And another wrinkle is that it doesn't work, at least in shorter events, if you have taken in some food or some carbohydrate before you start. It only, like, if you wake up in the morning and you go for a 1 hour run, then rinsing and spitting a drink will enhance your performance. If you wake up in the morning, have a bowl of porridge, and then go for a 1 hour run, it won't work. So your brain is performing these very, very subtle calculations about, you know, not only how much fuel is in your body, how quickly you're using it up, whether there's more on the way, how far you have to go. And it's using that to determine how fast it's going to allow you to go, which implies that under normal circumstances, when you're going as hard as you can, that's not limited, strictly speaking, by your muscles. It's limited by your brain's calculations of what's okay for your muscles to do. And this is something that has, as I said, it has some practical implications. Like if you're running a marathon, you know that by the time you get a few hours in, you're probably getting pretty sick of you know, whatever gel it is you're trying to squeeze into your mouth. Yes. And you may be running into some gastrointestinal problems, which are not fun. Right. So what you often see people do now is in the last, say, half an hour of a marathon, you still try, if you can stomach some sports drink or whatever, that's still great. But at the very least, you can kind of trick your brain by get some of the benefits of sports drink just by swishing it in your mouth for, you know, maybe 10 seconds or so and spitting it out. And that way you can get some of those benefits without the risk of having to take a detour to the porta potty or whatever the case may be.
Have you tried it?
I have tried it. So what's my subjective impression of it? Well, I don't know. Like, because the whole point is all of this goes on under the hood.
Yes.
Like I did it, but we're totally unaware of these calculations. So this is kind of an interesting point, because on the one hand, it's really important to, if anything you're doing, whether it's your fueling plan, whether it's trying something like rinsing and spitting, whether you're trying mental approaches to racing, it's really important to try all these things in training and then in less important races and then in more important races, see how you react to them. But to me, the importance of that is to feel subjectively how it feels, whether you're comfortable with it. What, like, maybe when you try rinsing and spitting a drink, you find that you can't keep your mouth closed long enough because you're breathing so hard, and so you end up just pouring drink all over your shirt and then you're uncomfortable. Like, so that stuff, it's important to try out for those reasons. But in terms of assessing whether it allowed you to go 1% faster, I think for the most part, you're kind of kidding yourself if you think you can figure out whether it's working. And so that's, to me, that's where the science is important. It's like, to pick up subtle effects, we need lab studies that kind of control all the variables and yeah, test things multiple times. But it's still super important to find out whether it's something that you feel comfortable doing and whether that it works for you the way you run and the way you race and the way you train. So the first person stuff is crucial, but yeah, in terms of whether I got a super boost from rinsing and spitting, that's just a big question mark for me.
There was another lab study in the book where they had guys on bikes, I think, and they were flashing really quick images of smiley faces or frowny faces and then measuring performance.
Yeah, that was fascinating. Yeah.
Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's actually, so I would say if I had to pick one study that kind of is the perfect demonstration that your brain is in charge of the ultimate limits of endurance, that would be the one, because it gets around the placebo effect. It's not because the people didn't even know they were being manipulated. So just to back up, but basically this is a study by a guy named Samuel Marcora, who's done a lot of really interesting research. He's based at the University of Kent in Britain. And yeah, as he said, he had cyclists doing a time to exhaustion test in the lab, and on a screen in front of them, he was flashing these pictures of either a face smiling or a face frowning. but they were flashed for 16 milliseconds at a time, which is about a tenth the length of a blink. So you're not even aware that there's a picture of a face showing up there. So, and after the study, they did check. It's like, hey, did you guys notice anything funny? No, we just did our cycling. They had no idea that there were faces being flashed in front of them. But when they were shown the smiling faces, they lasted about 12% longer on the time to exhaustion test compared to the frowning faces. And so this is kind of baffling, right? Like, first of all, that it could work at all. And second of all, why, like, smiling faces versus frowning faces, like what difference does it make? So as a demonstration that the brain matters, I think that's really powerful on its own. So then, but then the next thing you can ask is, well, how or why? And the way Mark Hora would explain this is that ultimately what matters when you're trying to push your limits, what matters is not what your lactate levels are or what your heart rate is or all these things. All those things are influence your performance, but what really matters is your perception of how hard you're working, which is basically based on integrating all this information from your body and also from your mind. It's like what matters isn't your lactate levels, it's how your brain interprets that lactate level. And so things like a smiling face or a frowning face, they don't change anything below the neck. They don't change your heart rate or your lactate levels, but they change subtly. They just sort of subtly nudge your overall mood and your overall interpretation of how you are interpreting the signals from your body and from the rest of the world. So that particular set of lactate levels and heart rate and body temperature and stuff just feels a little bit less onerous when you're in a better mood, in a kind of happy face kind of mood, than when you're in a frowny face kind of mood. And this, you know, the same is true for the internal monologue in your head. If you're telling yourself, oh, this is so hard, I hate this, why do I do this to myself? That makes your brain's interpretation of the physical signals from your body a little more negative than if you're telling yourself, all right, I can do this, I'm ready for this, let's get it on.
If you're in a better mood, then you're more likely to push through the pain or not interpret it in such a dire way.
Yeah, exactly. Your effort. So your subjective interpretation of the effort associated with it running at a given pace will be a little bit lower. It'll be a little easier. Now, if you're in a wonderful mood along the lines of, I'm just so happy, the world is wonderful, I don't care what happens, then everything may feel easier, but you may choose not to push as hard. So it's kind of you have to be in that right mood where it's not just like, I'm happy right here where I am. In fact, I'm going to lie down by the side of the marathon course and have a nap. You want to have it feel easy, but also have the kind of fire in your belly that makes you want to keep pushing so that you're going as hard as you can. Yeah. So it's a balance.
When I was reading that portion of the book about the study about the happy faces and the sad faces, it made a connection with me because I'm sure many listeners have had this experience too. I've been running in a race and running next to someone who was just like groaning and moaning and, you know, even saying something negative out loud, like, oh, this is awful, I feel awful. And there's like every fiber of my being wants to get away from them. It's like, this is bringing me down, I have to get out of here.
Yeah, totally. And then you can think of like the times when you pass a friend or a family member who's just cheering you on. And sometimes they may add motivation. They may, it's like you want to go faster because your friend is cheering you on. But sometimes also it's just so nice to see a friendly face and you just feel better about things. And it just kind of brings you a sense of ease. So there's just all these different ways that the environment can bring you down or up.
It gives me a new appreciation for people that spectate at races and hold up the motivational signs and the funny signs.
Right.
Well, totally. And I did. So when I first started reading about some of this research, I ended up running the Ottawa Marathon a few years ago, and that I was trying the rinsing and spitting and stuff like that. But I also enlisted my friends and family to, I basically gave them one instruction. I was like, stand at random places around the course and make me smile, surprise me. Don't tell me how, but so, like my parents were there wearing like ridiculous hats and I had friends holding up, it's just crazy signs reminding me of funny things we'd done in the past. And again, it's like, I have no idea whether it actually helped me, but it is interesting. I'm much more aware now that when I'm out running and if I'm pushing hard, I tend to sort of adopt this sort of grimace of despair on my face. And it's like, that doesn't actually help me run faster. I don't need that grimace of despair in my face. And if I just become aware of it, for instance, by having someone cheering me on in a way that tries to make me smile, I'm able to relax my face. And even if I don't start sort of grinning like a maniac, I can take that sort of anguished look of despair on my face, which kind of feeds into that feeling. It's like, if my face is in that tortured expression, that is also it's kind of telling my brain that I must be hurting. There's kind of a, you grimace because you're hurting, and then you feel like you're hurting because you're grimacing. So it's there's a sort of
feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That can build. And I think it can build positively or negatively.
You talked about a coach who would look for kind of like a loose bottom lip or kind of a slack jaw versus a clenched. And what did that mean?
So there's a famous guy named Bud Winter who actually was a sprint coach back in the 50s and 60s. He coached some of the famous sprinters like Tommy Smith and John Carlos who won Olympic medals in 1968. But he got his start training fighter pilots during World War II. And one of the things he noticed was that the guys who were able to excel in dogfights, he had the sense that they were also able to stay relaxed. They even while they were put, under great pressure and had to be performing physically, they stayed relaxed, and it manifested in their body language that they had a relaxed face. So he wrote a book called Relax and Win, and he was all about if you're running along and your lower lip is not bouncing, that means your face is tight. And if your face is tight, that probably means your shoulders are tight. And if your shoulders are tight, your arms aren't swinging loosely and your legs aren't swinging the way they. So it just sort of so on down the chain. And so he was big on relaxation cues and learning to run relaxed. And that facial relaxation thing ties into exactly what I was saying before about noticing that I've got this sort of grimace of despair in my face. That's like a really tight facial expression. And so I'm not necessarily trying to smile when I run, but I'm conscious of trying to catch myself when I've got that effort face. And think of like Bud Winter, the sprint coach, his famous like feel your your cheeks should be bouncing, your lips should be bouncing, you should be able to go without like I found this this Sports Illustrated profile of him from I think it was the early 60s maybe, where the reporter describes him doing exactly that. He's like, you want to sprint well, this is how you got to sprint. You got to be able to go with your lip. So it's a sort of funny image, but it's like it stuck around, and it's one of those things that was very, it was like coaching wisdom. I remember when I was a teenager having coaches tell me that sort of thing, and now only now there's research that's saying, hey, what this guy was saying 40 years ago makes sense. There was a study even just a few months ago that where a guy in Northern Ireland, he asked runners, he put runners on a treadmill and he asked them to smile, and they got measurably more efficient by about 2%. Their running economy improved. So they were burning 2% less energy to run at the same pace when they were told to smile. And, we don't know exactly what's going on, but chances are it's some connection with being able to relax and kind of change your mood and also the way you're carrying your body.
So if people are listening to this episode while they're running, we want them to at least smile, if not that, do the lower lip thing.
Yeah. Either do the motorboat with your lip, or at the very least, stop looking like you're in the throes of death. Like that's the thing to avoid.
I think we've all had that experience of, looking back at race photos and not knowing a photographer was there. And then you can like see the horrible look that was on your face, like this grimace. And you thought, I didn't know I looked like that when I ran.
Yeah, I have a weird thing where people after races, people will sometimes ask me, it's like, what was so funny? Why were you smiling? And it took me a while to figure out that when I have my full on grimace, it's of like my face is totally contorted. It actually looks like I'm really smiling. And it's like, no, that's not a smile. Trust me. That's me like, trying to tear my face off, basically. But it just, to some people, it looks like a smile. So I guess it can go either way.
On the flip side, it sounds like you could really get into someone's head if, like, let's say everyone was shouting, you suck, as these runners are going by.
Yeah. I like to think that the running world is pretty collegial and supportive, that's not going to be an approach that catches on. But yeah, I think back to, so when sports psychology started to kind of catch on in the 70s, and there were like books about tennis, the mental side of tennis. And I can remember as a kid being told like, hey, listen, if someone aces you in tennis, don't fret, you compliment them on their serve. Say, oh my God, what a great serve that was. What are you doing with your elbow or something like that? So try and make them conscious of their motion, and also just kind of puff them up about how hard they're serving, so that the next serve they'll try and serve even harder, and they'll likely serve it into the net. And it's like, you know, all this stuff that was, again, it was kind of folk wisdom that people had accumulated by experience. And now there's increasingly science that's sort of showing us how these things work. And yeah, in running, if you get people to focus too inwardly, to like think about how their legs are moving, all of a sudden it's like, imagine trying to tie your shoes. We're all pretty good at that, I think. But if you were to like, if you have to break it down to each motion, okay, first I cross this one, this lace over that lace, and then I have to make the bunny, and the bunny goes around the whole, around the tree. It gets all complicated, like these things are automatic. And so, you know, shouting at people, this is kind of a digression, but yeah, like shouting at people or making people aware of their body movement is actually a good way of making them kind of lose focus and get less efficient. But this is all dark side arts, which I'm not recommending. But I think you're right that if you were moved to do that, you can get in someone's head and fill them full of doubt.
You could say, man, your feet are landing pretty hard. I can hear your feet slapping the ground. Then they'll think about that the whole time.
Yeah,
it's dark stuff.
I was going to say, this is like, I do not endorse any of these techniques. this is not the path to enlightenment, but it is interesting to think about how these things can work.
Okay, one more quick digression. I remember I heard an interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and back in his bodybuilding days when he was competing, he would go in the gym and his competitors would be at the same gym, and he would say, "Your legs, they look kind of smaller than they have in the past. I mean, look at mine. And have you been skipping leg day?" And he would just get in these guys' head. And then for weeks, these guys would work on nothing but legs.
And then he would win with his big biceps.
Yeah, psychological warfare. You know, another interesting part, this is toward the beginning, you talked about mental fatigue. And if you go to a marathon and you're just exhausted mentally, your brain's not going to have the focus to do what it needs to do, it sounds like. So it kind of reminded me of the importance of not being stressed out before a marathon, because a lot of times if you go to a big city marathon, all the logistics and just getting to the starting line is a huge undertaking and can be pretty stressful.
Or people spend a lot of time, you know, doing like touring before the marathon and, you know, trying to fit in all this stuff. And yeah, that can kind of decrease your focus maybe.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, obviously the touring stuff is you know, you always know, oh, don't be on your feet too long before the marathon. And we always know, like, don't, you know, you're not going to run too many miles the week before the marathon. I understand you're going to taper your training, but I think it's really underappreciated, the role of mental fatigue. And you know, this is something I think people kind of understand intuitively, in the sense, like, I know for me, if I have a full day of work, or if I have a deadline, say an article deadline at the end of the day, and I'm scrambling to hit that deadline, and it's stressful, and I submit an article at 4:59, and then try and go for a run at 5:15 with friends, that run's going to suffer. Like that's just the way of the world. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, it's like, hang on, you know, like I didn't actually get up from my chair all day. Like I physically should be fine. So then you realize, well, yeah, it takes mental focus to have a good run. It's kind of pushing yourself in a run is the sort of the equivalent of holding your finger in a candle flame and just being able to hold it there and resist the urge to pull it out. It takes a lot of focus. And so there has been research in the last few years that really demonstrates how powerful the effects of mental fatigue are. And they can sit someone down at a computer for 90 minutes, which is not all that long, right? Compared to a typical workday, right. 90 minutes at a computer doing relatively simple tasks. It's like letters or arrows flash on a screen and you press one button depending on which letter or which arrow shows up on the screen. It's really easy, but it requires focus. You're supposed to be sitting there like, okay, that letter, bam, you hit the button. So you do that for 90 minutes. And what's interesting is then you say, get on a bike and do a time trial or a time to exhaustion test. Right from the very start, your perceived effort is higher. So this goes back to what we were saying earlier, that what matters isn't really what your legs are doing, it's how your brain perceives it. Yeah. And so your legs aren't tired, but your brain's perception of how hard it is to sustain that effort is harder right from the start. And so you end up going slower or reaching exhaustion sooner. And so to me, this is kind of, it's a great illustration of something that I think I neglected a lot, you know, during my racing days, which is, you shouldn't just have a physical taper where you back your training off. You should also try and incorporate a mental taper. Like, and the classic mistake is, if you've been marathon training, you've been putting in hours and hours of training every week, and then it's like the last week, it's like, thank God, I only have to do half as much training. I can finally do my taxes and, you know, catch up on all the errands that I haven't done.
Taxes, that's harder than training.
Well, exactly. And so the last thing you want to do is on the Saturday before your race say, oh, thank God I've got 6 hours to do my taxes. you know, so, and just more generally, it's like, if you've spent 3 months or 6 months preparing for a race, man, try and keep that those last few days before the race relatively chilled, relaxed. Like you said, like the stress of traveling and the logistics of picking up your number, man, if you can get that, even though, like, you know, like the vast majority of us are balancing jobs, and so it's not like we can fly out there on a Wednesday and just chill in the hotel before a Sunday race. But if you can make the travel work on the Friday afternoon or Friday evening so that you give yourself Saturday just to relax, get in the hotel room, watch some mindless TV or read a relaxing book, and just give your mind a break, then that, well, at least what the research suggests, is that'll have a measurable effect on your race. If you can go to the line, not just physically fresh, but mentally fresh.
Yeah, I was thinking when I was reading that portion of the book, like you said, keep your mental space as light as possible. And I was also thinking, I'm an introvert, and so having a lot of social interactions the day before a race, you know, to me, that's pretty exhausting, you know, so just kind of knowing yourself and realizing these things, like, can go a long way to making your performance better.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, which is, I get questions like, well, okay, is a book good or bad before a race? Or is it, you know, exactly what should I do? And it's like, well, you really kind of have to know yourself, like you said, and the classic example is going and spending a bunch of social time. And I'm like you, social time for me, I enjoy it, but it's draining. Like, yes. I feel tired afterwards. And there are other people who are 100% the opposite. Going out and spending an afternoon with some friends the day before a race might leave them feeling great and relaxed. And it's different for them. And I think we all, if you stop and think about it, you have a sense of what leaves you feeling like, oh boy, I need a break, and what leaves you feeling, yeah, that was great, like, let's get going. And you have to kind of, you know, you still have to fill those hours someday. So I'm not recommending that you just, like, check into your hotel and stare at the wall for the next, you know, 48 hours, which is, to be honest, it's like, when I was younger, I was a really, really nervous racer. And I kind of made that mistake sometimes where I was like, I don't want to do anything that can interfere with my race. So I'm going to sit in my hotel room and I'm going to think about my race for the next 36 hours. And it's like, by the time I'd get to the line, I'd be totally, like, just insane with nerves that I'd kind of rattle myself to pieces. So finding some distractions is good, but you got to sort of think a little bit about what puts you in your happy place and what relaxes you.
Yeah, so you don't want to be in your head too much, but we can't necessarily give you a list of acceptable books and movies that are going to work for everyone to be light enough.
I would say probably the best approach is to get this book Endure by Alex Hutchinson.
Yes.
And just read that over and over again, and, you know, yeah, it's guaranteed 7.3% performance enhancement for sure.
There you go.
And the MTA podcast too.
Yeah. Listen to that, read the book, listen to the podcast, and you're in business.
Well, this would be a good time to thank this episode's sponsor, Omax. They're the maker of Omax 3 Ultra Pure Supplements, the purest omega-3 supplement on the market, containing nearly 94% high-quality omega-3s.
Yeah, you can even do this cool thing called the Freezer Test Challenge. So basically, if you freeze any other omega-3 supplement, it'll probably get cloudy because that is all the filler that is in there in addition to the fish oil. Meanwhile, the omega-3 soft gel remains clear because it's that pure. And better yet, omega-3s are amazing at alleviating joint pain and muscle soreness, making you feel your best post-workout, and they can improve focus and memory, boost cardiovascular health, and more. And it really makes sense to take a daily omega-3 supplement, which is something that I've been doing for years, and I think it's made a big impact in my health. So we encourage you to try it for yourself.
Just go to tryomax.com/marathon to get a box of omega-3 Ultra Pure for free. That's tryomax.com/marathon to get your free box of omega-3. We'd also like to thank Sunbasket for sponsoring this episode. Sometimes it's hard to eat right and to eat clean, especially if you're low on time. But Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience or lack of experience you have in the kitchen.
That's right. They have 18 weekly recipes all delivered to your door that you can choose from. There are plenty of options. You can choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, vegan, pescatarian, and many more meal plans. And better yet, Sunbasket works with the best farms and suppliers to bring you fresh organic produce and responsibly raised meats and seafood. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep, so you can get a healthy, delicious meal on the table in about 30 minutes, which some evenings with soccer practice and everything we have going on is very important.
Just go to sunbasket.com/marathon today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/marathon for $35 off. And finally, we'd like to thank Health IQ for being a faithful podcast sponsor. You may have heard our interview with Ryan Hall, who holds the fastest marathon time for an American runner. Ryan is also a Health IQ customer, and they actually helped us reach out to him for the interview. He said, Health IQ is perfect because it's made for people like me with a healthy, active lifestyle. The lower heart rates that many athletes have can sometimes negatively affect insurance rates, but Health IQ actually uses your active lifestyle as an asset to get you a good life insurance rate rather than your lower heart rate being a detriment. You can see if you qualify by taking one of their famous lifestyle quizzes, and also you can talk to one of their friendly agents.
They are the official insurance partners of the Roadrunners Club of America and USA Triathlon and the American Trail Running Association. 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 to 33% on their life insurance. To see if you qualify, get your free rate quote today at healthiq.com/marathon. That's healthiq.com/marathon.
So there's a lot of great stories, too, in the book, and it really keeps it moving. Can you maybe give us a couple examples of people that just accomplished incredible feats of endurance? Like, it could be in the running world or outside of, but what are some of the just most brutal feats of endurance that you've come across?
Well, I'll tell you the one that surprised me the most, because it was kind of new to me in a world that I hadn't explored before. So you think about running, right? And it's like, you know, you're breathing hard when you run. And you think, oh, yeah, oxygen must be a pretty key limiting factor. So I was asking myself, okay, well, how long can you go without oxygen? What is the actual limits of breath holding? So, you know, there are competitions. Free divers do these just pure breath holding competitions to figure out how long they can hold their breath. And I was totally blown away by the records for breath holding. So
this is scary stuff, folks. So.
Yeah.
I'm getting short of breath just thinking about it.
Brace yourselves.
Flashing on the screen is the disclaimer of do not try this at home. Yeah. But yeah, without further ado, the world record for breath holding is 11 minutes and 35 seconds.
Oh,
and
goodness.
This is not, you know, David Blaine did stuff with where he breathed pure oxygen beforehand and stuff. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about just like no tricks, nothing fancy. Just hold your breath, 11 minutes and 35 seconds. So what's interesting to me, and I had a chance recently, actually after the book came out, but I had a chance to chat with a guy named Brandon Hendrickson, who set the American record for breath holding last summer or last spring of 8 minutes and 35 seconds, which is still amazing. Mm. So the deal is, if I try and hold my breath, I will reach this point. If I'm really highly motivated, so I'm like, I'm going to just hold it until I can't anymore, I'll reach this point where my breathing muscles start to contract involuntarily. And that is basically, it'll force me to breathe. And that feels like a physical limit. But it's actually, that's not because I'm running out of oxygen. That's actually a warning sign triggered by the carbon dioxide levels that are rising in my blood. So if you're well-trained, like one of these elite free divers, you can basically ignore these spasms of your muscles. They still happen. Your muscles are contracting, but you just keep your mouth closed and keep, you know, fight through the pain and you keep holding your breath. And so what Brandon Hendrickson told me is, so for him, in his 8 minute and 35 second American record, the involuntary breathing contractions started a little bit after 4 minutes, between 4 and 5 minutes.
Wow.
And, you know, so his muscles kept spasming. So there's a factor of two there between the apparent physical limit and then what he was able to reach by just having trained himself to ignore that warning sign. So, and obviously you can't extrapolate breath holding to every other case of physical limit. It's not like, oh, I feel like I can run a 3-hour marathon, therefore in reality I can run a 1.5-hour marathon. That's not how it works. But it is interesting to get a sense of how big that safety margin is. It's like,
yeah,
the warning sign goes off for me at like maybe 90 seconds tops. Yeah. For Hendrickson, he's trained himself, the warning sign doesn't go off until, you know, 4 minutes. But he doesn't run out of oxygen till closer to 9 minutes.
How does he know when he starts ignoring the warning sign and then he goes another 5 minutes or so? How does he know?
I mean, I guess at some point your body might just pass out to like take over that breathing.
That's exactly it. And so one of the questions that people often have is like, okay, we have these warning signals. Do you think maybe they're there for a good reason and that it might be dangerous to ignore them? And it's like, yes, for sure. They're there for a reason. And 99.9% of the time, no matter how hard you try, you can't get to the point where your body actually fails. Like if I step out the door now and just start sprinting and say, I'm going to run myself unconscious, I will not succeed in doing that. I'll get too tired before I actually run myself unconscious. Yeah. The breath holding thing is one of the very, very rare exceptions where people who are extremely well trained in this, they literally can hold their breath until they pass out from a lack of oxygen. The oxygen reaches a point where that's the minimum to sustain consciousness. And of course, if you're a free diver and if that happens underwater, you're going to die. Right. So it's very dangerous. So with Brandon Hendrickson, with his 8-minute and 35-second breath hold, you know, he's at a point, he's pushed so hard at this point, and he's also so hypoxic, his brain is kind of short on oxygen, that he's no longer making good decisions, and he could conceivably just hold his breath till he passes out. Now, in the rules for international breath holding, that doesn't count. To count as a record, you have to stay conscious, and then when you finish, you have to complete the safety protocol saying, I'm okay, you make a hand signal, and so on. So you have to be able to recognize before you hit that point. So what he told me is he and his sort of coach had agreed, based on their previous sort of training and experiences, they thought he could do 8.5 minutes. And basically at 8.5 minutes, it wasn't that he reached the point where he couldn't stay under anymore. It's that his spotter started tapping him on the shoulder saying, okay, stop, okay, stop. And he was a little bit dazed. So it took him 5 seconds before he was like, Oh yeah, I guess I did. I guess we did agree I was going to stop. So then he stopped at 8 minutes and 35 seconds.
Wow.
But it was like, it was a plan that had to be made beforehand, because at that point he had turned off all the alarm signals and he would have just kept holding his, or could have just kept holding his breath until he blacked out.
That's crazy. Makes me glad I'm just a runner.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, some of the stories in the book, and it's like, you know, Antarctic explorers pushing themselves across this unknown terrain and mountain climbers going to the top of Everest. I'm like, man, I would love to try that. This is amazing. The breath holding stuff and the freediving stuff, it's like, whoop. No, zero interest. It's like, it's amazing there are people who can do that, but that just like, it feels like kind of diving into an abyss to me. It's just like, it's scary even to think about, and to think about the discomfort required to keep holding your breath. It's, I mean, I guess people think that about running too. And yet, right. Yet I find running wonderful. So I won't judge, but it's definitely not something that where I was like, sign me up. I want to try it.
And you do talk about people who've pushed themselves beyond the point of no return and did die. Like, for example, with the Arctic explorer, was his name, his last name, Woosley?
Yeah, Henry Worsley. He tried to walk across the Antarctic unaided. So basically, he was pulling a 300-pound sled, no resupplies, no dogs, no nothing, just pulling his sled across the Arctic. And after about 70 days, he was still, I can't remember, maybe 100 miles away from where he needed to be. And he reached the point where he knew he couldn't go any farther. And he radioed for an air evacuation, which he got. But in the next day, he died of massive organ failure. And the reason that I thought this was interesting, and I ended up writing about this, and I think the second chapter, sort of right at the beginning of the book, was because it's so rare. Because he didn't run out of food, he didn't freeze to death, he didn't injure himself. He basically pushed himself voluntarily to the point of complete failure. Hmm. And going back to Tim Noakes, who we were talking about earlier, one of the things he told me, I asked him, like, where did these ideas come from? What made you first start to think about the brain's role and limits? And he said, you know, what struck me is that it's not that occasionally people die running marathons or climbing Mount Everest or whatever, because, you know, that happens. But it's what's interesting is not so much that it happens occasionally. What's interesting is that it happens so rarely. When you think of like all the people who have pushed themselves and how motivated they are, like you think about all the Olympic silver medalists in the marathon over the years who've come into the stadium a few seconds away from immortality, knowing that if they can just dig a little deeper, they will be the Olympic champion. And they push as hard as they can. They cross the finish line. They don't win. They don't die. They grab their flag and they jog around the track waving the flag. So it's like there's something that prevents, even under the greatest motivation, that generally prevents us from pushing ourselves, as Noakes went on to propose. But it sometimes happens. And so it's like to write about limits, I thought it was important to sort of say, well, what's on the other side of the boundary? And there's these rare cases where someone like Henry Worsley, who was a special forces trooper from Britain, he'd been on 3 Antarctic expeditions, and he had a real personal interest. He was trying to retrace the steps of Ernest Shackleton from a century earlier, because one of his distant ancestors had been the navigator on one of Shackleton's expeditions. So he felt like he was kind of living out his ancestral destiny to try and complete some of these expeditions that Shackleton hadn't managed to complete. So he was a tough guy. He was a motivated guy. He was sort of obsessed with the Antarctic. And he put himself in a situation where, you know, he was crossing the Antarctic with no backup. All he had with him basically was his satellite phone where he could call for help. And that's a big, you know, if there'd been some sort of less drastic way of calling for help, he probably would have called for help a day or two earlier and the outcome might have been different. But because it was all or nothing, and because, you know, when Shackleton was doing these expeditions, you know, Shackleton is really famous because he was trying to get to the South Pole first and he got pretty close. He got like 100 miles away and they still had food, but they didn't have enough food to get back if they kept going. So he was like, all right, we could be famous and make it to the South Pole, but because we have to leave enough margin to return, we better turn around. So they turned around, they lived and didn't make the South Pole. And then Scott, a few years later, made the opposite decision. He was kind of in the same situation as Shackleton. He said, you know, forget it. Let's go to the South Pole. We're going to get there and then we'll do what we can. And they all died on the way back. So it's like, and to me, that's kind of a metaphor for the central governor. It's the central governor is trying to be like Shackleton for you. It's trying to say, you know, no matter how badly you want to get to the South Pole, sometimes we need to hold ourselves back for safety. And right. So Henry Worsley, because he's in the age of the satellite phone, he doesn't have to make the decision of being able to get back. So he, unlike Shackleton, he doesn't have to have his sort of central governor saying, all right, let's make calculations. Will we be able to make it back? Let's leave a margin of safety in case anything goes wrong. He can just say, I'm going to push till I can't push anymore. And then I'm going to call for help. And unfortunately, he was so good at pushing himself that, and, you know, there's probably some underlying thing that, you know, he may have had, you know, pushed himself so hard that he got an ulcer and that's what led to an infection or, you know, he lost like 50 pounds. Like he was pushing himself in various ways, but one way or another, because he knew he could call for help at any minute, he was able to keep pushing himself until it actually turned out to be too late.
So what was the official cause of death?
Officially, I think the autopsy said massive organ failure. And they think it was secondary to something called bacterial peritonitis, which basically meant an infection in the lining of his abdomen. The question is what caused that? And I've seen some speculation since that he may have had an ulcer that burst, which allowed the bacteria from his gut to then get into his abdominal lining. And then that caused it to get inflamed. And then that ended up leading a systemic infection that led to a massive organ failure. But it's not really clear. It was one of those things where they couldn't figure out what they knew. He had some infections, but at that point he was so weak that his system had been kind of overrun by infections. So it wasn't clear what precipitated it, but basically, yeah, his internal organs just stopped working. It was effectively what killed him.
Okay. Wow. Now, one of the overarching storylines in the book is about the Nike Breaking 2 project. So remind listeners of what that was and, you know, kind of your role in being an observer during that.
Yeah. So last May, Nike staged this race that they called Breaking 2, which was an attempt to produce a sub-2-hour marathon. They'd selected three of the best runners in the world to go for it, and they'd spent 2 or 3 years leading up to it, and probably tens of millions of dollars. They wouldn't clarify exactly how much, but
I think they have the money.
Yeah, well, they certainly poured a lot of resources, and the idea was it was kind of this: let's do everything that science can think of to make a fast marathon. So that went from like optimizing the course. So it was held on a Formula One racetrack in Northern Italy, mm-hmm. which meant that it was almost perfectly flat and had very gentle curves on this loop. And if you think about that, you know, some of the fastest marathon courses in the world, like Chicago and Berlin and London, they're pretty flat, but they have, you know, two dozen or more sharp turns, you know, right angles or sharper. Right. And each of those turns takes a little bit out of your legs and slows you down a little bit. So they were optimizing the environment. They were trying to optimize the temperature, that picked exactly the right day, and they had a new pair of shoes. It's called the Vaporfly 4%. That was pretty controversial. That they have, it has a carbon fiber plate in the midsole, and it has the, you know, a fancy aerospace foam that's the most resilient foam ever. So you get like 90% of the energy back when you squeeze the foam; it bounces back.
So what's the deal with the carbon plate?
Yeah, well, that's okay. there's lots of debate about what exactly the carbon fiber plate does. Nike's explanation basically is it kind of, so you've got this a thick foam midsole that's really spongy and kind of springs back and gives you energy back. And then the carbon fiber plate adds a little stiffness to that spongy marshmallowy midsole, so that one of the areas you lose energy apparently is when your big toe bends, you kind of dissipate a little bit of energy there with each step. And the carbon fiber plate keeps your toe a little straighter to prevent you losing energy there. And it also, it's a curved carbon fiber plate. It changes the angle of your foot when you're pushing off. And one way to think about this is, like, if you're trying to do pull-ups, if you do a pull-up starting with your arms halfway bent, it's like a billion times easier than if you try and do a pull-up starting from a dead hang. Yep. There's the way your muscles work, there's some positions that are more efficient for delivering force. And so the idea is this carbon fiber plate gets your calf muscles up in a slightly different angle, so you're just able to deliver force a little bit more efficiently than with an ordinary shoe. There's a lot of debate over exactly how the carbon fiber plate works and how it combines with this big, thick, foamy midsole. But the upshot of it is that there's external testing showing that it makes the average runner about 4% more efficient. So you burn 4% less energy to run at a given pace. So that was a big factor with this breaking two thing. And they had six pacemakers running the entire distance in this sort of arrowhead formation that they'd optimized in wind tunnel testing to eliminate the effects of air resistance. So they had all these factors, all these sort of scientific things that they were bringing together to try and optimize how fast someone could run a marathon. And in the end, Eliud Kipchoge, who's the defending Olympic champion from Kenya in the marathon, he ended up running 2 hours, 0 minutes and 25 seconds. And so it's not a 2-hour marathon, and it was not a world record, because the way they did the pacemakers, they had pacemakers shifting in and out partway through the race, and you're not allowed to do that in world record races. But it was a lot faster than most people thought. And so, I was covering this for Runner's World. There were Nike allowed two reporters to come go behind the scenes with this project. I was one of them for Runner's World, and Ed Caesar from Wired was the other guy. And so we spent a lot of time following this project and really getting into the weeds of what it was that would enable Kipchoge to run this fast. But, the interesting thing for me is, and I wrote a ton of articles and spent a lot of time, arguing with people online and stuff like that about what exactly was going on. But as time has passed and I look back on the project and the kind of lessons, what sticks in my mind is less the sort of technology and the details of the science. And it's more about, like, what was Eliud Kipchoge's role in producing that amazing time? What was it about him that allowed him to excel, whereas the other two runners who were in the project, they didn't do so well? They ended up running like 2:06 and 2:14 or something like that, so a long way from 2 hours. And I think back to the first time I met Kipchoge, which was about 6 months before the race, and he had just run a half marathon, just under 1 hour. So he's going to have to go twice as far at basically the same pace. And I asked him, like, Eliud, how are you going to change your training in order to be able to go twice as far at the same pace? And he said, I'm not going to change my training. The training will be the same, but my mind will be different. And at the time I thought, that's a terrible plan. how is that going to help? But it became clear that he was really sincere about this. And, in interview after interview, he was sort of expanding on this idea what he felt was really important was to create the belief that he could do it and to be confident in that. And by the time we got to the race, like before the race, it was really clear that he believed he was ready to run that marathon in 2 hours. And the other two guys didn't believe that. They hoped they would, but they didn't seem to believe it. And so I look back on that and it kind of underlines to me the role of all these things I've been talking about in the book about the role of the mind and endurance. And it's like we were talking earlier about smiling. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Kipchoge, halfway through the race, he started to smile every mile or so. He would deliberately smile. And again, like, people were saying, why is he smiling? He can't be enjoying this. And I was thinking, oh, he's not smiling. He must be like me, where his grimace looks like a smile. But after the race, he said, no, I was smiling deliberately. I don't run with my legs. I run with my heart and my mind. And the smiling helps my legs feel my mind, or something like that. And again, it was like one of those things where I'm like, that sounds a little kind of touchy-feely. I'm a skeptical guy. But as time has gone on, I look back and when I look at the research that I've looked at for this book, I think, okay, I think, actually Kipchoge, he was systematically in his own way building up his endurance and working on that mental aspect of endurance. And you know, you really have to respect that. Like, he is the Olympic marathon champion. He's you know, one of the greatest marathoners in history. And it's like, he knows something. And so, the conclusion I come to is like, all the stuff that I talk about in my book, I don't think it has much to offer Eliud Kipchoge. It's not going to make Kipchoge faster because he's already found his own way of getting to that point of being able to push, you know, really close to his limits. But I think maybe what it does is what the research offers is this kind of roadmap for the rest of us to sort of move in that direction to be a little bit more like Kipchoge.
How did he feel? Did you get to see him like right after he crossed the finish line? And was he disappointed with himself? Was he happy because he ran faster than anyone else ever in the marathon?
Yeah, no, he's definitely happy. I mean, how did he feel right after the race? He was tired. Like, he lay down on the track and, you know, he left it all out there. But he was very quickly, he was happy. And since then, it's been pretty clear. He views it as a success that he showed it's possible to run a marathon in 2 hours. Right. He didn't run the marathon in 2 hours, but I would agree with him that, you know, he did what a lot of people thought was impossible in running, even in running 2:25. And he showed that, like, if he can run 2:25, it would take a bold prediction to say nobody can run 2 hours under those conditions. It's like, you know, Kipchoge's great, but someday someone will have a day that was better than that day. And under the right conditions, they might run under 2 hours. So yeah, I'm sure he would have been even happier to run 1:59:59. And I'm sure his bank account would have, blossomed accordingly. But, he was very happy and rightly so. Like, this was one of those things, you know, for anyone who followed this whole project, everyone remembers that there was and there remains lots of skepticism about it and lots of like cynicism about this giant marketing stunt by Nike. In a sense that people felt like it felt like there were two camps. Either you thought it was this giant marketing stunt by Nike or you felt it was this amazing experiment into human endurance. And to me, it was like, I don't understand why you have to choose between those two. Like, it's of course it's a marketing stunt by Nike. Like, it is explicitly a marketing endeavor by Nike. It's that is what it is. Of course they want to sell their shoes, but I don't think that rules out the fact that it can also be a pretty cool kind of exploration of human endurance. And so when I was there watching the race, I was certainly aware of all the sort of cynical currents that were going on, and shared some of them. You know, like I also sort of wondered about whether there could have been other ways of doing this that were less sort of corporate. But as the race went on and it just became a focus on Kipchoge, it was like, it was a pretty special thing to see. And by the time he finished, like, everyone who was there was kind of overwhelmed with, you know, almost despite themselves.
Got into, like, the spirit of it.
Yeah. It was one of those things where, you know, everyone had the Christmas spirit by the end, whether they intended to or not, because it was just an amazing performance.
And it wasn't open to the public. So it's not like the stands were filled with people, right?
No, I think that's too bad.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if he had like tens of thousands of people cheering at the end, maybe a couple seconds would have gotten taken off. Who knows?
It's interesting because it's this Formula One track and there were a few hundred people clustered around the start finish, but it was a 1.5 mile loop. And so for like 1.2 miles or whatever, he was out basically in a forest running by himself with nothing but the pacers in front of him. It's hard to say. Like, at a certain point, this wasn't a race where he was setting his own pace or anything. He was just trying to run with the pace. So it's like the crowd had nothing to do with his pace for the first, 20 miles because he was just following the pacemakers. But if there'd been enough people there for those last, 3 or 4 miles, could he have dug a little deeper? I don't know. It's certainly a question worth asking and maybe one that we'll only be able to answer with a future multi-million dollar event.
Well, hopefully you'll be there to cover it if
I know.
We do it
yeah,
again.
I'm sure you will.
I hope so.
Well, we're definitely living in exciting times with the level of interest in our sport now, and we could even see a sub-2-hour marathon in our lifetime. Just, I think we're living in exciting times. And I tell you what, folks, get the book Endure by Alex Hutchinson. Before we let you go, is there a good place to find you online that maybe you can tell listeners about?
Yeah, I think the easiest place to find me is on Twitter at @sweatscience, and I post links to any articles I write and so on. My website is alexhutchinson.net, and that has a little more background information, but those two places are probably the easiest places to start. Thanks so much for having me. It's really been fun to kind of chat about some of this stuff and how it applies to the real world in some ways.
Definitely. All right, well, have a good day. Alex, appreciate you letting us interview you.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, thanks, guys. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alex Hutchinson. I got to tell you, folks, we have read many good books and interviewed many good authors, but this is a great book everyone needs to get. There are so much more in there that we didn't even get to. Like, he has a whole chapter on oxygen, a whole chapter on muscle, what causes your muscles to fail, for example. He has a whole chapter on fuel, heat. It's very in-depth. Plus, there's so many fascinating stories that keep the narrative moving. It's a great read. So, Angie, I knew that you were onto something by your insistence on smiling throughout the whole marathon. Like, you were stumbling upon something psychologically beneficial to your running by doing that.
Well, I can't say I smiled during the whole marathon, but I try to remind myself to smile, especially as the miles get longer and the discomfort tends to mount.
Almost every race photo of you, though, you're like glowing.
I don't know about that. It must be the sweat.
Well, it's interesting to know that our limits, our limitations as, you know, runners are more elastic than we think. The limits are there, of course, but probably most of us have never even come close to reaching them. I know I haven't. I never run till I collapsed. I know that. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks again to Acer, maker of the Acer Swift 5. Go to acer.com, click on store, enter the code training to get 10% off plus free shipping. Just want to remind you guys to dig deep, run strong. You are capable of way more than you probably give yourself credit for. And of course, if you want to send in a comment or question, we've got a contact form on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at Marathon Academy. Hope you enjoyed the show. We always sign off the same way, and that is to remind you, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way.